This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, hey, thank you so much, Parker. I'm Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. Almost 2 years ago, I saw a post by one of my photographer buddies from Detroit. Ken Settle is his name, and Ken is a world-class storyteller and a gentleman I would love to have on the program one day. But on this particular day, he told a story about a Michigan visit by the legendary Jimi Hendrix. The venue was the Fifth Dimension, a teen hangout, from what I have learned, located in Ann Arbor, and it just so happened that a young freelance photographer was on hand that evening to capture what would become iconic photos of the young, largely yet unknown Hendrix. Now, I chatted with this gentleman briefly, and we posted an exclusive content episode in January of last year. Since that episode aired, I have wanted to get back with our guest and get him back on the program to talk more about his photography. He is a photographer, but he's also a musician. We're going to hear more about that. So let's welcome our guest, Wilson Lindsay, to Time Signatures. How are you, my friend? And welcome back to Time Signatures.
Thank you very much, Jim. And I'm feeling great.
It is so good to have you back, man. Honestly, I've looked forward to this since we met the very, very first time. I know that you weren't feeling well at the time, but it's so good to see you feeling better, man. I don't know what to say.
Well, thank you. That particular time was very rough, but I'm glad to say I'm over it.
Yes, sir. Well, listen, I'm going to take more of a circuitous route for this episode because in talking to you before we recorded this time, I've learned that you really have some fun backstories. So I want to begin the way I start with most of my guests, Wilson. Talk about your earliest memories of music. Would you do that for me?
Absolutely. I remember it pretty well. In elementary school, I would duck out during lunch periods and go to a coffee shop down the street from the elementary school, and they had a jukebox there. And one day I went in and I heard this otherworldly type of sound coming from the jukebox, and it was amazing. It was Bo Diddley, and he was singing Mona, and I had not heard anything like that before. My grandparents, whom I lived with my sister, because my parents had died at a very early age. My grandfather was very much into music, primarily jazz. He was a musician himself as a young man. And the music that he played was a lot different than what I heard on that jukebox, which was dominated by people from Chess Records, anybody from Bo Diddley to Chuck Berry, as well as Muddy Waters. And but it was Bo Diddley that really caught my attention. Chuck Berry, too, was really interesting, too. But this was before Chuck Berry really started to, I was about 8 years old at this particular, Chuck really crossed over and became the great artist that he, that everyone knows. And since then, I was kind of hooked. Liked Elvis Presley, so did my sister. But for some reason, I was more attracted towards the blues at a very early age. And there was my grandparents on my mother's side with their love of music, they decided that they were going to try something out with me. Babysitters were hard to find, and we went to a club, or I should say, they went to this club, and it featured Jackie Wilson,
Oh, wow.
a native Detroiter, and he and the club was at a place called Idlewild. It was a small place in the middle of the woods,
Yes, sir.
near Baldwin or Reed City.
Yes,
Those are
sir.
big. But whatever the case is, it was right in the middle of nowhere. But that little resort town had some of the greatest talents you could imagine. And seeing Jackie Wilson as a child, his unbelievable stage presence, and he put absolutely everything behind his show, and the way that he communicated to the audience was spectacular. So
You know, I
those were
love
my
the way our conversations go because you're always showing me a new layer. And to hear you talk about Idlewild is incredible because I know that Idlewild was a particularly African American enclave.
Yes.
Still to this day is. And as a matter of fact, Garrett and I attended Idlewild last year for their Jazz and Blues Festival. And what an experience that was.
Bet.
But that, so you were there as a young boy.
Yes, my folks,
Wow.
prime babysitter, and that's why I ended up the club with them. And of course, they kept you away from anything resembling a drink. But
Sure,
whatever
sure.
the case was, it was an amazing experience, and I wanted to go back again as soon as I could, but that wasn't in the cards. But nonetheless, it was an amazing memory. And from that day on, I was a major fan of Jackie Wilson. He was the greatest showman I had seen, perhaps until I saw James Brown. But whatever the case is, those were my earliest, how would you say it, exposures
W
to roots music.
Wilson, did you ever make it back up there?
Yes, I did make it back up.
Okay.
I'm trying to think who I saw. He kind of faded away. It could have been Chuck Jackson.
Okay.
That was the second. I believe it was Chuck. Anyway, those were my earliest memories, but I really started to look into music a lot more seriously when I was about 13. And my grandparents and my father's side said, "Okay, if you really want this, I'll get you a guitar." And by the way, I found this old camera in the drawer, and I'm going to throw it out if you're not interested in it.
Oh, wow.
And it was an old Argus, which I believe was the first commercially available 35 millimeter
I believe you
camera.
might be right. Yeah.
And I took one look at the camera and said, "Yeah, I want to try this out." And from that day on, I was addicted.
So your first camera, I'm curious about this because I'm also a photographer. And I remember my clunky old Yashica TL that I had. It was a nightmare. It was heavy as hell. Tell me a little bit about this old Argus. Tell me about it.
I remember it vividly
Okay.
because I fell in love with that old tank. It was tough.
You could pound nails with it, right?
I absolutely, and it was exceedingly primitive, but it still worked. And The shutter speed was pretty close to accurate. And I pleaded with them for a flash. And after a while, I learned the differences in the type of films. Tri-X, obviously, sure, was my goal. And I started taking pictures of something that I was really interested in at that time. It was professional wrestling. And at that time, you had characters like Leaping Larry Shane and the Crusher, Dick the Bruiser, the Sheik.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys were out there, and I was really fascinated with that that type of thing. And I started to take pictures. I'd run up to the stage, grab a couple shots, run back, and I would eventually find out who was behind it. And it was a fellow named Johnny Doyle.
And you're how old at this time?
14, 15.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
And for a long time, right after the shows, I would show him these pictures, and he would take a look at the pictures and said, "Son, you need some practice." And but I didn't give up for some reason. I just found him, and I kept showing him these awful pictures. And after a while, I started to get better. And he did let me know how to get to CKLW a TV where they filmed the promotion bouts there for the big shows at Cobble Hall and
sure.
Olympia. So I was a regular at Windsor, and it was really easy to get across the border at that particular time. You didn't have to jump through a lot of hoops.
So you're 14 years old, you're crossing the border into Windsor, which isn't, for people that don't know, it's literally across the river from Detroit. It's not like it's a 50-mile trek or anything, but still, that's quite a thing to be doing at 14, right?
Yeah, I guess so. In retrospect, I didn't mind taking the bus at that time and getting to where I needed to go.
Sure.
I was pretty independent as a child, and I did get backing, from my folks for a while. Eventually I wore Johnny down, and he hired me when I was 16 to
wow.
take pictures of the wrestlers, and that opened my eyes to a world very, very large. And
now, I don't want you to go too far yet, but I have to ask you, what
sure.
Do you remember how much that first check was, and what was that like getting paid for doing something you love?
It was $35.
And this is in what year?
This was 63 or 64.
Okay. All right. What was that like, man, getting that first? I mean, it's that $35 was a lot of money back then.
I thought so. And it my folks thought so too, from the standpoint that they didn't have to buy me any film, and the chemicals that it took after purchasing an enlarger and that type of thing. And so I was kind of independent from that era. And on top of it, I really enjoyed hanging out with the wrestlers themselves, because they had a lot of interesting stories about their lives, how they got into wrestling in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stories were kind of amazing, actually. There was a fellow named Carl Gotch, which is the name that that he wrestled under. He
okay.
was a very, very good wrestler. He was a little on the older side, I suppose, to the majority of the wrestlers out there. But his name was Carl Eastas Krauser. And he once, coming back from a bout in Saginaw, Johnny Doyle was driving, of course, and I got into a conversation with Karl Krauser, and he described being in a concentration camp. He was
Oh,
from
wow.
Belgium, and the Nazis had rolled in there, and they just took people by the train load from
Wow.
the and that type of thing. He was a child at that time,
Yeah.
and he told me what it was like to escape from the concentration, to be in the concentration camp, and then escaping. Not wanting to get into detail, I guess. It was one of the most horrifying stories I've ever heard, and
Wow.
it opened my concept to what the Holocaust was about.
Yes, sir.
And it wasn't that long ago in retrospect, because
Right.
we're talking maybe 64, and the war ended just 20 years before that, really.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that long ago. And he told me how he managed to get work back in Belgium after the war and what mess the place was. Anyway, that was just one of many stories that I heard from on a number of the wrestlers, and it was absolutely fun hanging out with them. And all I can say is I loved that job. I would have done it for nothing. No
Well,
question about
thank goodness you didn't.
it.
But
But it was a great job.
oh, Wilson,
One.
I want to turn the page here a little bit without going too far into the story,
I'm
because
sorry.
this work. I'm sorry, go
That's,
ahead.
I said I'm sorry about going off
No,
on that.
you're this is great. This is great. You're doing fine. Don't worry about it. But I want to start delving into the work that developed for you for the Detroit Free Press. About how old were you? And you parlayed this wrestling work into some stuff with the Free Press, didn't you?
Yes, in fact, if I didn't work for Johnny Doyle, I probably wouldn't have got in the front door of the Free Press.
Sure.
First place, I was too young, number one. They already had a bunch of really good photographers working for the paper. But they were accepting pictures that I took of the wrestlers to attach to the stories and the rundown on who won and who lost on the weekends. So they knew that I took the pictures, and they asked me if I wanted to follow Muhammad Ali, well, at that time, Cassius Clay,
Okay.
around. He was training, and he was promoting the upcoming championship fight with Sonny Liston. And
Wow.
so I said, yes, absolutely. I was a boxing fan as well.
Sure.
So I got a chance. They said, okay, here's the data. This is where he's going to be. So go there and take as many pictures as you can, and let us know how things went. That was my, how would you say, guidance from the Free Press the first time around.
And you were
But
with
it,
him for how long?
well, he was in town for 3 days,
Okay.
and after school, I would go right to the place that he was working with, which. Actually, he was around quite a few places. There used to be a boxing gym on Woodward Avenue across from the old Werner's Pop Factory.
Okay.
And so he would train there. And so after school, I would go and hang out with him, and I took bouts of him training with the with the other fighters there, and he would be making appearances around town, just promoting the fight. Mm-hmm. And even then, I noticed that he could turn on that hyperbolic personality of his with the snap of a finger. But he was a lot more introspective and quieter when things calmed down. And, you know, he and the photographer, that his official photographer, from what I understand, followed him. I can't remember his name, but I'm sure it's easy to look up. Anyway, he was with Muhammad for the entire stretch of his life, the entire wow. arc of his career plus. And he really embraced me as a kid wanting to learn and eager to learn. And it was one of the most remarkable times of my life when it came to learning a skill. And anyway, I'm just glad it happened and I had the chance.
And seeing that photograph that was shared in the Free Press from 2022, the article that was written about your work, the picture where he's standing outside the building, he's got his hands up, you know. I mean, yes. Clearly there was my opinion, looking from the outside, you genuinely had chemistry with him, didn't you?
Yes. And I met him a couple of other times after that. And
I was going to ask you, did you see him after? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and he was just really wonderfully ebullient personality. He was so kind and open. And, I just felt, that I could be myself with him at the same time. There were a lot of private moments, that he just was himself, which was a lot different than the image most people have of him.
I was going to say, when you said that he was a lot more introspective, that's not the Muhammad Ali that I ever saw, because he was always, when the camera was on, he was on. He was a showman.
Absolutely.
And you're saying there was totally different personality in private, huh?
Yes.
Wow.
How cool. He had a type A personality and he was mm-hmm. very outgoing. There's no question about that. But I guess it took an awful lot of energy to keep that going all the time. he relaxed a bit, and he was very much a showman, and he had sure. very little, how would you say it? Let me put it this way. After the warm-up bouts and so forth, he had no problems walking around butt naked. And just relaxing, being himself. And that was another thing that kind of caught me by surprise. Although I'd been in the dressing rooms of the wrestlers more times than I could count.
Sure.
But all I can say is, that is the private side of Muhammad Ali. He was different.
Wilson, as I was reading that Freep article from 2022 that I just talked about your illustrious career, listen to some of these names, folks. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, The Who, Cream, The Faces, and of course, Jimi Hendrix. I'd like you to talk about some of those early shoots with the bands who are now among the most legendary.
Well, I had a really good person to work with at the Free Press. Mm-hmm. She was extremely well-respected, and she had contacts that were just amazing. And her name was Lorraine Alterman. Mm-hmm. And she took me along on most of the, she had her choice of photographers that would accompany her.
Sure.
These interviews, photo shoots, concerts, et cetera, and she just kind of adopted me and took me along with these interviews and that type of thing, which is how I actually got a chance to see and chat with Jimi Hendrix the first time when he was at the Fifth Dimension in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, we're gonna come back to him. Don't get into that one yet. I want to hear about some of these other bands that you shot with too.
Well, I can state unequivocally that the most fun were Rod Stewart and the Faces.
Okay.
And these were party guys. And we just hung out, partied, laughed, and one of them gave me the name Wiley Wilson because I would go and put together mix cassettes,
Okay.
which became popular later, but I would make these cassettes of tunes that I wanted the guys in the Faces, particularly Ron Wood, to check out. And they just loved it. I would see these guys, they would be in Detroit a lot. And it was definitely one of the fir their favorite towns to play in. And they had tons of friends there in town, and they were just wonderful to hang with. And these were young guys. They left it 75% on the stage, and the other 25% they would play afterwards, and
Okay.
in all kinds of respects. But
Sure.
it was a good time, particularly with those guys. The Who was always great to hang out with, and they supplied a lot of really kind of wonderful, iconic moments. They were such great stage presences, and I got some really good shots at them performing, particularly at a somewhat of a disappointing show in Flint, Michigan, which was an outdoor show. And it was only half full, but all I can say was, man, they gave it their all. It was an amazing show.
Wow.
So
And they were
there
pretty
was
much at the peak of their careers at that time, weren't they?
They were starting to become
Okay.
known at that particular time. They had a very strong fan following
Wow.
general area, but the British invasion was just starting to gather strength at that particular, and it they had all kinds of shows and TV appearances that they would come in and to promote their shows, which generally were not at the big houses at that particular time, like the Grandy Ballroom, for instance.
Right.
Some of the greatest acts in history came through the Grandy, and
Yes,
I'm
sir.
proud to say that that my band played there, The Train, 9 times. So,
Wow.
had a chance to hang out with them above and beyond the free press photography job, but to open up for a lot of these acts at the Grandy. So that too was another aspect of being in the rock slash blues time,
Now, I would imagine, in addition to shooting some of these bigger bands like we just named off here, you
Yes.
probably did a little bit of work with some of the Motown artists as well.
Yeah, I did some sessions at Motown.
Okay.
And there were no singers. They didn't say who the sessions were for, but eventually I identified some of the tracks that I did for the Marvelettes.
Okay.
Managed to track those down. Strangely enough, a few years later, I ended up going to work for Motown on the other end as a regional sales rep.
No kidding.
So, yeah, I was pretty familiar with both sides of the Motown business.
Well, I want to flip the page here because you've referred to yourself as phenomenally lucky. And speaking of being phenomenally lucky, on August 15th, 1967, at that teen club called the Fifth Dimension, you captured a young, not yet world famous guitar player named Jimi Hendrix. What led you there that evening? And please tell the story in any amount of detail you would like. The floor is yours.
Well, Lorraine Alterman asked me if I wanted to, to cover that gig. And I said, absolutely. I mean, there was no doubt. In fact, it wasn't too far. The Animals, Eric Burdon and the Animals were in town. Mm-hmm. And I took pictures of them and covered them during their appearance in Detroit. And Eric was just raving about Jimi Hendrix. He said that, he was the greatest guitar player in the world, but the record wasn't out. So no one had any copies, so he didn't know how he sounded. But I really liked the Animals, and I took what Eric said very seriously. And so when I was asked to cover the Hendrix thing, I just jumped on it. And that's how we ended up at the Fifth Dimension. Lorraine interviewed him. Jimmy was just phenomenally talkative and relaxed. And he got into a mock debate with the other two members of the group about who had the best afro. It was just a fun and fresh situation for him, to play back in the United States. He had gone to England, and he was really busy there.
Yes, making, he was.
Making some incredible impressions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... To be around him, you knew that he was anxious to impress, but he also had the feel of a musician that had been around. And there was a number of gigs that I played that would be in the Chitlin' circuit. They called it Black Clubs around mm-hmm. Michigan. And Jimmy had played practically all of these clubs with other acts.
Wow.
He had played with Little Richard and some other people, the Isley Brothers. And so he had already been through Detroit, but he was playing other clubs.
Okay.
And so this trip was definitely a different type of appearance for Detroit. And it was with his own band. And of course, the guys from England, and so he was anxious to impress. He recognized that Detroit was an important town. When I got into the other end of the music industry, Detroit was a top eight market.
Okay.
And as a result, and I'm talking primarily monetarily and influence wise,
mm-hmm.
You wanted Detroit in your back pocket if you were an up-and-coming artist. You definitely wanted this town because it was one of the music capitals of the world. And financially, Detroit, they bought a lot of records. And as a result, this was a place to be. And he wanted to impress, just like everybody else that came into town.
Sure.
So the reputation of the Motown artists, and particularly, and of course, the guys over at Golden World, on and on, you know, you wanted to be in this company. And so the out-of-towners, when they rolled in, they usually put out their best. And that feeling lasted pretty much through the entire time I was in the other end of the business.
Okay. Now you talked about being in that club, and it was a smallish club with a small stage, and
yeah, I think 100.
You had difficulty shooting. You didn't have a lot of space to shoot. You ended up actually on the stage with Hendrix and the band?
Yes. I couldn't figure out how to navigate the guys that were pushed up against the stage. The stage was only about 2 feet tall, and it was small. And Jimmy and the guys had these heavy-duty marshals around them, which took up pretty much all of the extra space on the stage. So I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to get up on the stage and creep around out of the sight of the guys, hopefully, and try to get some pictures. And that's what I did. Back in those days, you had a lot more access to the artists. And that lasted for a little while longer. I mean, at the Grand, for instance, everybody was hanging together. If you were opening up for the act or whatever the case is, we all hung around the same couple of rooms. So that type of thing disappeared over the years. You didn't have that access when it came to coming to the stage and photographing them. It changed, and it changed overnight. I'm not quite certain. I have a feeling that it was mostly financial.
Okay.
They wanted to control the output of the pictures.
Yeah, nowadays you're limited at a lot of venues by a lot of the artists to the first three songs of their set. That's it.
Yeah.
And you're done. And they will come and haul you out by the seat of your pants, man. That's
yeah, it's a lot different now.
Yes.
But the stars were not as isolated. They hung around, you know, they chatted it up with other musicians. That too is kind of an isolating situation, but, you know, it is what it is.
Well, Wilson, as I recall from our initial visit, you talked about another event that you covered with Hendrix at the IMA in Flint, but you
yes.
claimed that he was less receptive at that show, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a totally different person than the first time that that I met. And I was warned by one of the roadies first that he really doesn't want to talk. And he was not in a very good frame of mind. But being the kind of pushy kid that I was at that particular circumstance, I just went into the dressing room and started to chat him up, and he wasn't having any. He said, "Get the hell out." So I left the scene about as fast, tucked my tail underneath my butt and left. But
well, that must have been a real it must have been a difficult situation for you to be feeling, because you were received so warmly the first time.
It was surprising.
Yeah.
But the fact that when you deal with artists, you know, you have to accept the fact that, you know, they're not all on all the time. And they have their ups and downs just like everyone. So,
yes, sir.
Decades in the business of working with artists very closely, you know, you accept that aspect of the artistic personality. And so, you know, it doesn't destroy me. I don't take it personally.
Yeah. Well, Wilson, I want to flip the page one more time here.
He didn't even play a complete set, by the way, in Flint.
What, I'm sorry, go ahead.
He didn't even play a complete set in Flint. He played a few tunes, a string broke, and he stormed off.
Wow. So he must have really just been having a bad day all the way around.
Yeah. I wish I could say that I knew what had happened in the background that that troubled him so much, but it was obviously something. I noticed that in his preparations for the show, his band wasn't around. They were somewhere else. Their dressing rooms were completely isolated from him. You know, that camaraderie wasn't even there.
Wow. Yeah. So a totally different atmosphere all the way around.
Absolutely.
Wilson, you talked earlier about your work as a musician, and you referenced it on our last visit. I also understand that you have a pretty significant story tied to that part of your life, and I would love to hear about Howlin' Wolf, man.
I would love to tell you about him because okay. he was such a wonderful person. My landlady at the time, we lived in Corktown area, downtown area of Detroit, and Chester Howlin' Wolf had friends with made friends with my landlady, and they had been friends for years. And when he would come into town, he would visit her, have a good meal, chat it up, and what happened was the first time I had met him, other than say, you know, hi, that type of thing at the Chessmate or some other club that he may have been playing. Mm-hmm. We were rehearsing in the basement, and my wife said, there's someone at the door pounding away. I came up, and through the glass areas of the door, I could see who it was, just a shadow, but it was a looming shadow that I immediately recognized. I opened the door, and I thought it was going to be a dream, but it was Wolf, and it was Hubert Sumlin. And they said that they had heard me from next door, which was pretty easy, I guess. My landlady was a saint. And he came over, he sat and chatted, and Hubert went down in the basement and played with the guys. And it was a wonderful introduction to him. As time went by, he was on dialysis, and
we're talking about Hubert.
Pardon me?
Talking about Hubert?
Sorry. Wolf was on dialysis, and okay. He wasn't playing much, but he said that he had taken a job at Big Duke's in the west side of Chicago, and he was doing it for the guys in the band. Hubert's was not feeling well. He was having a hard time with his marriage. He was sick. And Wolf asked me if I wanted to come in and do a couple of sets. And, you know, I could stay at his place. So that's what we did. My ex-wife and I hopped up and took off to Chicago, and we stayed at
So
Wolf's Place. And
he hired you to come in from Metro Detroit to Chicago to fill in for Hubert.
yeah.
Wow.
And that's how I spent some time with Wolf. He was living at a nice place on 88th and Cottage Grove at that particular time,
Okay.
and that's where we stayed. And Big Duke's, rough place. In fact, there's a obscure video on YouTube that featured an interview with Wolf talking about the music business in general and business in general there at Big Duke's. And when I discovered this video about 6 months ago, and it just blew my mind because it hadn't changed from the time that I was in there with Wolf from way back when. It was the same thing. I mean, everything, the furniture was the same, the backdropping of this pit was the same. The swinging doors from the inside of the club into a liquor store were the same, and it was a real flashback to that experience. It's not an easy gig, but there was really not that much pressure. Wolf would come
Sure.
in and he would play a set, and that would be it for the night. And the band, we just improvised and jammed. So
Wow.
that was that experience.
Yeah. Now, Wilson, I know that you had obviously a ton of photographs that you took through the years, and unfortunately, you lost many of them due to a flood.
Yes.
But I would like to ask you, because I'm sure there's people out there that would be interested in obtaining some copies, purchasing some copies of Hendrix and others if you have them available. I know you have Hendrix photos. Who else do you have available that you would make available for sale?
I have a few others that managed to survive, a few of the Who.
Okay.
Oh man, I haven't stopped taking pictures at all through my lifetime. But off the top of my head, I'm going to say that I've got a few of the MC5
Okay.
and a few of the other guys from that era. I'd actually have to take a look. Some of the faces,
Sure.
but yeah, I haven't really pushed for selling pictures. My direction in photography has been towards nature photography, and I just love it, and it rings every bell I can think of emotionally. And
Sure.
physically, at this time, being able to get out and enjoy the outdoors at the same time,
Sure. But
take pictures.
if people were interested in photos, how would they reach out to you and request pricing and copies?
You can reach me at wilsonlindsay@yahoo.com.
There you go. And you're on, is it okay to have your Facebook out there too? We can put a link on the page and when we do the What's that?
No problem.
Okay. All right. Wilson
Facebook.
Lindsay, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking time once again to talk to me today. This visit was even sweeter than the first on many levels because there were so many pieces of the puzzle that I missed out on the first time. But boy, we sure got them all today. I want to thank you so much, and I appreciate you, sir.
It has been my great pleasure. You are a phenomenal interviewer, and
Thank
I
you.
just love what you're doing out there, Jim.
Thank you, sir. Well, before we close this edition of Time Signatures, I want to tell you about Joe Bonamassa's Keeping the Blues Alive Foundation. Now, some of you know the KTBA for their annual cruises, but did you also know that they have a program called Fueling Musicians? Now, this initiative is designed to provide financial support such as food, shelter, and more to help struggling musicians, music educators, and industry professionals get back on their feet. Additionally, they also have KTBA Records, a label that has reignited the music careers of musicians like Dion, Joanna Connor, Larry McRae, and others. There's so much more. Please visit keepingthebluesalive.org today and make a tax-deductible donation if you would. It's time and money well spent. And as always, thank you so much for your consideration. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Wilson Lindsay, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.